I ask you stand now for the reading of God's Word. And turn with me to Daniel chapter 3. One of those great stories of faith which you learned on your mother's knee. It's a long chapter. I'm just going to focus in on the last handful of verses here, beginning at verse 24. Here's the holy, infallible, inspired, and inerrant word of the living God. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded, and he stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, "Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" And they replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men loosed, walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire and responded, and he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on their bodies, and nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. And Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies, so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." And then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. You may be seated. An article was published last week in the Washington Examiner that had an alarming headline, which reads, "Americans giving up on God and miracles." Well, if you read the story, you know what I read, which is that this was a story about a group of people who are called nuns. Not N-U-N-S, religious workers. Nuns, N-O-N-E-S. That is, they are people who have no religious affiliation. If statistics are correct, due to basic surveys, there are 55 million of these self-identified nuns in America today. And here's the thing about them. 80% of them used to go to church. 80% of them grew up in church and went to Sunday school and heard the stories of the Bible, which we're going to, well, I hope they did, which we're going to read about this morning in Daniel chapter 3. But one of the things that this study attempted to do was not just measure how many of these people were there, but to ask them, why are they a nun? There were all kinds of staggering results that were furnished from this study, but one that's at the very top of the list is deeply concerning, that 50% of those who put themselves in this category claim that they are nuns because they just can't believe in miracles. And if they can't believe in miracles, well, they can't believe in God. And if they are pressed to say, well, why is it that they can't believe in miracles and why can't they believe in God, at the top of the list of the reasons that are furnished is because of science with a capital S. In other words, the perspective of the nuns is that if you can't find God under a microscope, he must not be there. And so the thought is that people today simply cannot align themselves with a faith that is expressed in a book that was written thousands of years ago. And the reason they cannot align themselves with such a faith contained in such a book is because they present two radically different views of the world. And so as it turns out, the more you read this story, the more you find out who the hero is. It's those daring, brash, bold young people today who are finally pushing back the headwaters of ignorance because they have determined to use rationality rather than believe in the old myths and fables contained in a book that was written thousands of years back. And as you think about that perspective for a moment, you can almost say, you've got me. It is hard to believe in miracles today, isn't it? In fact, we're told to look for miracles not from God or in the church or through prayer, but through technology and medical advancements. But then as you begin to press that claim and to examine it and to look at it from different angles, it begins to sort of reveal its cracks or its chinks in the armor, if you will. And one of those major cracks or chinks in the armor of the claim is that people just can't believe in miracles anymore because we've become too sophisticated. Is that if you look at the history of the world, one thing that you'll find is that people have never believed in miracles anyway. They've never found it easy to believe in such things. One of those indicators that might confirm it, that it's always been hard to believe in miracles, is what we have before us here in our text. Because if you will look at me, with me at verse 14, or rather 15, you will see the expression of a lack of belief in miracles from the very mouth of Nebuchadnezzar, where he says unto Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what God is there who can deliver you from my hands? You see, what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here is he's seeking to challenge faith. And what he is challenging faith with is the strength of his hands. And as you look at Nebuchadnezzar's hands, and particularly if you're in the position of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you would have a problem believing in miracles too. Because on one hand, you have before you a powerful king who is able to snuff out the life of anybody that he wants to by merely snapping his fingers. On the other hand, if you would look on this side of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what you would see is a fiery furnace with the flames leaping out of the top. And then if you look at the other side, you see over here a huge statue that he has erected, and he has demanded that all people bow down before and worship. You see, he stacked the deck of cards all in his favor, if you will. And he has said, you will bow down before that idol and pay homage to it, even if your heart is not engaged, your body is going to do what I tell you to do, or you're going to be thrown in the fire. And he taunted these young Jewish men. And he challenged their faith in that moment, saying, who are you going to believe in? The strength of my hands, or the power of your God? Nebuchadnezzar doesn't believe in miracles, and he's banking on it that these Jews don't either. And see, as you examine just that tiny little thread of our story, you begin to realize that believing in these things has never been easy. That one of the things that emerges from our story here, which fuels faith, is found in the very words of Nebuchadnezzar himself. And we're making a habit of this now as we look at these texts. We're finding the point of the text in the words of a pagan king. Because here they expressed in verse 29, and I'm sure you're going to hear the echoes of what we've just said back in verse 15. Because here, after the miracle, after they have been delivered from the fire, here is what Nebuchadnezzar said. I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there's no other God who is able to deliver, mark the last words, in this way. Remember, just a few verses ago, he said, "What God is there who is able to deliver you out of my strong hands?" And after the Lord has shown his power, he says, "There is no other God." And how does he know there's no other God? Not just that there are many, because he says there's no other God. That's what he says. And how does he know that? Because of the very way in which he delivered his servants from the flames of fire. And so the point of our text this morning is that the very way God delivered his saints testified to the fact that he is God alone. I want you to view this very familiar story, which you've known your whole life, from that perspective, with those eyes of faith. This passage is about magnifying the glory of God, yes, but it is about teaching the lesson that the very way in which God delivered, he showed himself to be the only God. We're going to unfold that main perspective or that main idea under two heads. No other God could produce such a miracle, and no other God could produce such faith in his servants. It's those things yoked together as you look at this passage that tell us, this is the main point of our text that's being unfolded here, that God, in the very way he delivers, shows that he is God alone. And the first way we're going to examine that is by showing no other God could work such a miracle. See, the very way in which he works tells us there's no other God who could have done such a miracle. Now, what we want to do is take some time here to deal with the narrative. We didn't read it, so let's just think through it quickly as we go back to the very first verse, and it starts the entry point into the story of God's delivering in the very way he did. Is the entry point is this big, ugly monstrosity of an image that has been built by Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 1, the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits. Its width 6 cubits, and he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. When did he do this? We don't know, but likely the association or relationship of the chapters here suggested it was within close proximity to the time of the events unfolded in chapter 2, probably within 2 or 3 years. Remember, the heart of the story there in chapter 2 is this image that appears to Nebuchadnezzar in a dream of this massive image that had various parts made out of different metals. But it seems likely, as Daniel even told him, "You are the head of gold," that Nebuchadnezzar comes up with this idea to build this enormous statue made out of gold. It's 60 cubits and 6 cubits wide. That roughly translates into 90 foot tall and 9 foot wide. To give you some perspective, the Statue of Liberty is 111 feet from the base where its feet are to the top. That doesn't count the platform that it's on. So it would have been enormous. Likely, it was placed on a huge platform. In fact, archaeologists think they've even found that platform upon which this statue was built. And that platform is 45 square feet by 20 foot high. No matter how you look at this, this image was massive and it was imposing. Just think of seeing something that large, covered in gold, glistening or gleaming in the summer sun. It would have been a spectacular sight. Well, Nebuchadnezzar built it partly to magnify himself. I don't think it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar. It was likely an image of one of the Babylonian gods, but it could have been something that resembled himself somewhat too. And here's the thing about that image, though. He said, "I want everybody to bow down and worship it." So if you look in verses 2 and 3, you'll read about a bunch of names. And these names are just offices of administrative personnel in the kingdom. You'll notice that it includes all kinds of people from all kinds of nations because he has conquered lots of nations. And so part of his policy was to bring peoples who he had conquered into his government administration in order to make them more favorable to him. So he's got all of these people and he gathers them into this huge field in the plains of Dura. And he gives a command to the people through his herald. And the command is essentially this. When the orchestra starts playing, you fall down and bow down before this image and worship it. And if you don't, I'm going to throw you into a fiery furnace. And that fiery furnace was probably something like a large kiln with an opening on the top and some doors on the side where they could have shoved the heat in. But it was likely built up around a hill or something so they could push people into it fairly easily. So what you have here is this image of, or this picture of a grotesque image and a hot fire. Nebuchadnezzar said, whoever doesn't bow down is going into those flames. And so the orchestra played and all of the people in obedience to Nebuchadnezzar dutifully bowed down. Except for, as now as you look at verse 8, the Jews. So verse 8 said, here comes the Chaldeans, and they came forward and they brought charges against the Jews. Likely by using the word Chaldeans, it's linked back to chapter 2 where they were ashamed. They were shamed by Daniel, who not only saved their life, but accurately gave the dream back that Nebuchadnezzar had and then interpreted it. And on account of that, Nebuchadnezzar elevated Daniel and his friends. Likely here, jealousy has been harbored. There's anger of the Chaldeans towards them. There's a little bit of xenophobia here. You'll note that throughout the chapter, they keep calling them Jews. But the anger of these people is evident in the original, which is not translated into English here. It said that they brought charges. And actually, it says in the Aramaic that they ate the pieces. They ate the pieces. And it's the language of gnashing and gnawing and chewing, and it's bitter, it's angry, which tells us that these Chaldeans hated these Jews. And so they come to the king and they begin to engage in a little flattery. Oh, king, live forever. And then they say, oh, by the way, king, didn't you make a decree? Now, this is music to a king's ears. When you hail him as O King, and then you remind him of his powerful laws. Remember, it was a command that he had given, and so they remind him of that great decree that everybody was supposed to bow down before this idol once they heard the music play. And then they say, but I just wanted to let you know, O King, in verse 12, that there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, they've disregarded you, and they do not serve your gods or the golden image which you have set up. Now, the whole way that they rat out their fellow administrators is pretty obvious that they're out for blood, right? First of all, they point out that the king has shown them great favor. He has elevated them into high and lofty and exalted positions, which, well, everybody knows what that means. You're supposed to return the favor by being a good, loyal subject. Well, they haven't done that, but worse yet here, they said they have disregarded you. You're the most powerful king on earth, Nebuchadnezzar, and these little punks from Jerusalem have disregarded you. And the thing that they have disregarded you in is your very faith, your religion. They do not serve your gods. They do not worship the image you have set up. All of this is designed to evoke a very harsh and visceral response. And of course, the objective is achieved, as you see in verse 13. Now, Nebuchadnezzar in rage and anger. This is using the A to Z of words that are about anger in Aramaic. This covers every word you could say. It collapses him in between, and that gives you an idea of just what a fit of anger that this king went into. And you see the anger is palpable, and its display as he calls for a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be summoned before him. And so here they are, standing before this king with all of his pomp and ceremony and the trappings of his authority and power. And he questions them. Verse 14, is it true? Is it true? That's not a bad translation. It could also be translated, was there any purpose in what you did? The point being here is that he likes these guys. He might be angry with them because they have disregarded his authority. But there is a tone of disbelief and even clemency here as he understands that his rage is probably overpowering. It shouldn't be that strong because he likes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he's trying to give them an out. Remember, he said, if they don't do it, they're going to get tossed in the fire no matter what. And here he's bringing them before them, and he's saying, is it really true? Is there any purpose? Is there some reason that I haven't understood? Maybe your knees are sore, or your back is aching, you just couldn't get down. And so he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have the orchestra play all over again. And this time, I just want you to do what I've asked you to do. I'm going to give you a second chance. Well, this is not what kings like Nebuchadnezzar are used to doing, by the way. He speaks a word and it better be done, or it's off with your head. He views human life as disposable. And just in case they might not have grasped hold of just how much he means this, now we have our quote that I've already read to you before. Well, what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? And notice here he is assuming that there is a religious reason for why they won't bow down. But now Nebuchadnezzar has turned this into a duel and a contest between divinities. I have my gods, and you have yours. We'll see which one is strong enough to win this. Is your God going to deliver you out of my hands? And he says that, by the way, with the snapple and cracking of the fire within their hearing, within their range of their hearing. And you know, when Nebuchadnezzar said that in that moment, I've got to believe that it was a fairly powerful question, because it didn't look like anybody could stop them. Yeah, one of the things that's hard for us sometimes to read these stories of faith when miraculous things happen is to imagine that if we were there, we would have done just exactly the same thing. Because, you know, you just kind of exercise a little faith and you engage a little civil disobedience and it all turns out good anyway, right? But there was no reason for them at all to believe in a miracle is going to happen. Zero. There is no reason to believe that they're going to live to see lunch. That's what makes this so gripping. Because if you look at it, Nebuchadnezzar does look like he has the stronger hand. Now we get into their response. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer concerning this matter. Remember his question to them? What God is there? They said, well, we're not even going to get into that question with you. Verse 17, they make an unwavering statement of faith. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of the blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O King. But you know, people of God, here's what makes this story so accessible. This is where the nuns better sit up and listen. These Jews weren't expecting a miracle. Even if he doesn't, let it be known to you, O King, we're not going to serve your gods or to worship the golden image which you have set up. This is the faith perspective. Of course, we believe that the Lord could move mountains by just saying that it should be done. But what is your experience? Is that what God does? Does God take away every ache and pain in your body? Does God remove every obstacle to your job promotion? Does God always work everything out in your relationships and in your life just like you wanted it to? Just because you prayed about it and you said, Lord, you're able to do anything. And all of a sudden, well, it just keeps happening. Every time I say, well, God, you're able to do it. Bam, there it goes. I would venture to say that's none of our experience. It's all of our faith. We understand that the Lord is the maker of heaven and earth, that His hands are on the wheel at all time, and He drives the ship of destiny, turning it to and fro, whithersoever He will. That's not our question. The question is the Lord bound to do those things? And we say no. And we don't even expect it. We expect that He's in control and He'll do all of His holy will. And that is precisely what these Jews say to this thug. But here's what they want him to know. That whether they can see God in heaven right before them, and whether He decides in that moment to condescend in this situation to perform a miracle, they're not going to do what He calls for. Because instead of being driven by what they can see with their eyes, they live by what the eye of faith shows them. God is the King of kings and Lord of lords. They're not to bow down and worship any graven images. And so they hold their ground. And then Nebuchadnezzar made good on his word. 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. The anger of the king is manifested in the heat of the flame, 7 times hotter than usual. Which means, get it as hot as you can get it, boys. Throw some gasoline on that fire. But just to indicate that he was all the more in control of the situation and that his hands were controlling it, notice what he does. He commands some of his elite soldiers to catch up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and tie them up. So we're told these men were tied up in their trousers and their coats and their caps and their clothes. See, he's taking no chances. Nebuchadnezzar is doing everything he can to ensure his will be done and not thwarted. Remember, this all has to be read in view of that backdrop. What God can deliver you from my hands? I want to see it. So he ties them up and he throws them into the fire. Now it's a strange scene, I have to admit it. Because you have 3 men all tied up and thrown into the fire, and now you have a king who bothers to look inside. And we don't know when this happened. We might presume that it happened immediately after they were thrown in, but I would doubt it. Because he's not expecting a miracle. And by the way, the last time somebody got too close to the flames, they got killed. So I'm going to suggest here that it's more likely that a good amount of time had gone by before he goes to see his handiwork. And so all of a sudden in verse 24, notice what you read here. The king was astounded and he stood up in haste and he said to his high officials, wasn't it 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire? He is riddled with shock. Remember our main point, it's the very way in which God delivered that showed him that God was God alone. And so he looks into the fiery furnace looking for some ashes. And what he finds is not 3 men, but now 4, as he says in verse 25. Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the 4th is like the son of a god. Notice here, he marvels. There are 4 men. And lots of attention is given to what they are doing. They are now loosed. Remember that they're thrown in bound. They are walking. They are not harmed. And there's a 4th person in there. Now, without spending too much time on that, because the commentators certainly do, you can go a couple of different ways. This is either a created angel, for this is the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. Calvin would argue that it's probably not Jesus Christ, pre-incarnate, although he's probably willing to leave the door open a little bit. And one of the reasons why he said that it probably wasn't is because Nebuchadnezzar said that he looks like the Son of God. Said Nebuchadnezzar says, well, this is an unbelieving king, so how could he recognize the Son of God? It's a reasonable argument. But virtually everybody else, well, not everybody, but a lot of people, including a lot of modern commentators, would go ahead and say, this is likely the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. And I think that the arguments that are offered tip in their direction, although I'm not really so interested in going into that right now. The main thing that we're to do is to behold this, the spectacle of four men walking around inside of a raging inferno, like they were taking a stroll on the beach on a warm and sunny afternoon. And so Nebuchadnezzar calls out to them. He runs by the fiery inferno and he says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out. He wants to see them all of a sudden. Remember, he was so angry at them, he was spitting nails a little bit ago, and he threw them on the fire and barbecued them like hot dogs on a 4th of July picnic, and now he wants to talk to them. Who wouldn't? If you could live through that, who wouldn't want to talk? And here's the thing the text goes out of its way to show us here is the condition of these men. And it's not just before Nebuchadnezzar. It's before an array of witnesses. We're told the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's high officials, all of the muckety-mucks of Babylon. And here they are with their gray beards standing before a miracle. And what do they see? They see the servants of the Lord. That the fire had no effect on their bodies. Their hairs were not singed, nor were their trousers damaged. And here seems to be the most important point. They didn't even smell like a barbecue. It's no wonder that this foolish pagan king cries out, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember this man who had these giant, powerful hands, who has the most powerful army of the world at his disposal, who has surrounded himself with vast building projects which testify to the power and the authority of this king. And we have this gaudy, ugly, massive, disgusting-looking image that's 90 foot tall staring at him. And in this moment, he realizes, as he looks at these men that don't even smell like fire, that he is nothing. His hands are nothing compared to the strength of this God. He stands astounded before this miracle. And he exclaims that they serve the Most High God. Calvin says, God wished to extract this confession from his enemies, that they would know it proceeded from the admirable and extraordinary power of God. You see, it's one of those miracles that when you hear about it at first glance, it seems rather unusual, but when you begin to read about the whole circumstances and the way it emerges in the narrative, the story is riddled with credibility. But what else are we to learn from this story, at least as we think about it in terms of the deliverance of these three men who are servants of the Lord? And it seems to me that one of the features of this story that we're called to appreciate is to see that God sent his angel to console his saints and to let him know that he identifies with them in their sufferings. There is no other reason for God to have sent this fourth man or to even have disclosed the presence of this fourth man. After all, the Lord is the maker of heaven and earth. If he wanted to protect Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the flames of the fire, he could have done it without doing anything. He could have done it without sending any angel at all or letting anyone know that there was anything there. Or that angel could have stood above the top of the fiery furnace and shouted out words of consolation from above. There's all different kinds of ways that this could have been made known. This miracle could have occurred. But the fact of the matter is, in this circumstance and in this situation, the Lord wanted to teach a lesson to His people. His people in exile, His people in their sufferings, His people in their misery. That the Lord doesn't stand outside of the midst of our trials and bark down words of consolation. He enters right into the very circumstance of our life. He enters into the very misery of our affliction. And He comes to stand alongside us, to comfort us with His presence. We don't have to be cast into the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar to know that Jesus Christ is with us in all of our sorrows. And whatever fiery furnace of affliction we are in. Because the Word of God tells us that we are so united with Christ and the bond of union is so profound and so strong that Christ is with us in our afflictions. I don't even need to tell you the most powerful and vivid image of the presence of our Christ with us in our sorrows and our difficulties and our pains and our afflictions is that profound image of the great shepherd in Psalm 23. Who not only leads us beside the quiet waters and causes us to lie down in the still pastures and leads us into paths of righteousness for our namesake, but He walks with us through the valley of the shadow of death, giving us the faith and the confidence to say, we will fear no evil. Why? Because the Word of God says, my rod and my staff shall comfort you. The very tokens of His presence are shown to us so that even in the midst of our sufferings and our afflictions, our cup will overflow with a sense of the mercy of God. And so we see here the very way in which God delivered was designed to show that He was God alone, and it was designed to console and comfort the church that our Lord identifies with us in all of our sufferings. But there's something else to be taken from this text, and it's not just the way in which God delivered in terms of the actual deliverance from the fiery flames, but there's something else that is indicated in our text that I think it's a very substantial message for us to appreciate too. And I think that Nebuchadnezzar was also overwhelmed with and impressed by the fact that no other God could produce such faith. No other God could produce such faith in His servants. And I take that from his words of testimony here. I mean, Daniel is telling us something through the words that he records from Nebuchadnezzar about how to appreciate this miracle. And notice here that he cries out in verse 28, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent His angel and delivered His servants. So he praises the name of God. He blesses the name of God. He says that this God has rescued them. And by the way, that word rescue is the same word that is used back in verse 14 when he said, who can rescue from my hands? And that verb means to deliver from physical harm. He taunted them and say, who can deliver? What God could deliver you from the harm of those flames? And now he puts that same word back in his mouth in the form of an anthem of praise to the Lord. Blessed be the God who has sent His angel and rescued His servants. And notice here that he says something very significant when he says that they're the Lord's servants. He acknowledges that he has no right to tell them to bow down to images and statues and to worship vanities. He says these are the servants of the Lord. But really the heart of the text is to describe these men. That's the point I want us to appreciate here, because I do believe that was foremost on Nebuchadnezzar's thinking, and the way the text is structured is designed to get us to see that this is all part. The very manner in which God delivered, remember, is the way that shows that He is God alone. And part of that manner is that the Lord inspired or produced extraordinary faith in the hearts of His people. And notice the ways that Nebuchadnezzar describes these men. They put their trust in Him. They violated the king's command. And they yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Three things. And I'll start with the middle one first, because I do think this is the one that was most galling to Nebuchadnezzar and really challenged him. Remember, he has raised them from small or young teenage men, and he's surrounded them with opulence, and he's provided them with material goods. He has given them an education. He would say he's been like a father to them. And what did they do? They thwarted and violated the command of the most powerful person on earth, and he took it personally. This word violated here speaks of great defiance. They defied the king's command. But in that defiance, Nebuchadnezzar saw something that was remarkable and genuine. And it seems to me that the connection of ideas shows us the source of that genuine and remarkable and even spiritually authentic defiance of the earthly king. And you see, the foundation from which that defiance flows is the first way in which he describes them. They put their trust in him. That's what was so mind-boggling to the king. Is how in the world did they put their trust in God in that circumstance? And the fact that they did that caused Nebuchadnezzar to wonder at the manner in which God delivered. The manner in which He delivered was not simply a display of power, not simply sending forth this angel to be with them in the midst of that fiery furnace, but also the very manner in which He delivered them was by instilling this faith in their hearts. They trusted in Him. Of course, that was a powerful word or statement of trust. Remember in verse 18, as we've already looked at it, even if he does not deliver us, let it be known we're not going to serve and worship other gods. You see, they had a great faith, because they had a great God who worked that faith in their hearts. The end of it all is that Nebuchadnezzar was able to testify, as we've already seen, that no one should speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Let's take home a couple points of application as we wind our way to conclusion here this morning. It seems to me the first point of application which we ought to take from this text is that it is a call to reject idolatry. It is a call to reject idolatry. After all, the storyline centers around the rejection of a gross idol. It takes no effort to see the rejection of the idolatry by these men. There was a large statue set up. There was an emotional and dramatic worship service. There was powerful music played. And there was a threatening call to worship. And they responded to all of that by refusing to worship and preferring the fiery flames of the inferno. They rejected idolatry. seems to me it's important that we ask why. After all, it is kind of a surprise. It is kind of a surprise on one hand. Don't you remember that these young boys grew up in a city where idolatry was running rampant? I mean, wasn't the reason why that Israel was overrun by this Babylonian army is because the people of God were offering worship to idols, even in the temple of the Lord? And so in one hand, you look at that and you say, this is odd and even extraordinary that they would have such principle and backbone when the rest of their people for a couple of generations had been riddled with idolatry. It should be odd to us as they were been nurtured and trained and educated in the king's court. It is odd to us that in that moment they would have such backbone and resolve and reject idolatry when no one would even be there to hold them accountable. After all, not even Daniel was there. There was just them. And who would have known if they had done this? In fact, the only way they could have been figured out is if they did exactly what they did, which was remain standing. We ought to appreciate why, in this instance, did they reject idolatry? The answer is they believed that they were bound by the authority of the second commandment. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to any graven images or worship them. I want you to understand, people of God, the reason and the basis for the rejection of idolatry is that they believed in the authority of the commandment of God. You shall not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. Matthew Henry says, there's enough in that one word of God to answer and silence all carnal reasoning. If we would make a bold stand against rejecting the rampant idolatry of our day, we must be persuaded of the authority of the second commandment. And if I could just think for a moment about the awful situation of the contemporary church, witnessing the floodgates of its youth pouring out of the church at 80%. I think we can say, though it's not the whole reason, that there's probably some connection between the desecration of worship and the exodus from the church. After all, if there is a God in heaven and He has no regard for how He is to be worshipped, and neither does His church, then why would I bother showing up? You see, in the name of reaching the so-called seekers, the church has desecrated and corrupted the worship of God and has lost its principles of worship because it claimed it would be better to sacrifice those in order to have the opportunity to reach some for Jesus. And the irony is that in losing its principles and desecrating its worship to reach the lost, it lost what it had. We ought to take no joy in reading stories about 80% of young people leaving the church as atheists. I don't care what kind of church they're in. It gives us no joy to hear that such a vast group of people are leaving the church. People of God, there is a connection, though. It reminds us of our solemn obligation to hold fast to the rejection of idolatry. Because it does matter how God is worshipped. The second thing I want to point to here is that devotion is sustained by dwelling upon true principles. Devotion is sustained by dwelling on two principles, and as our time is running out, I think I'd just focus on one. But this little quote from Matthew Henry is something you might want to tuck away to dwell on today. He says, "They were resolved rather to die in their integrity than to live in their iniquity." You go ahead and dwell on that today. They were resolved rather to die in their integrity than to live in their iniquity. Their devotion was fueled by principle that they were subjects of the Lord. But it seems to me the foremost thing that fuels this sense of devotion and commitment to the Lord was a prioritizing of God's glory. We should return back to this statement in verse 18 to lay hold of this great principle which seems to have governed their lives, as they said, "Even if he doesn't, let it be known to you, O King, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image." Now, I realize the words, they put God's glory first, are not exactly spelled out there, but what else is it that leads a person to say that? "We're not going to serve your gods or worship a golden image." What is it that accounts for that statement? Calvin says it very well. They treated God's glory of greater value than their own life. They treated God's glory as of greater value than their own life. This is what sustains commitment in the midst of great challenges, is a focus upon who we are and what we are here for. Seems that great question of Nebuchadnezzar, which he put to them, drew this into focus in their thinking. As he challenged them, saying, "What God is there who is able to deliver you?" And that brought into focus in their thinking what the purpose of life was. And obviously, the way they answered that question is clear. Pursuit of their own creature comforts was not their purpose in life. Their purpose in life was the glory of God. And if that meant face planting in the flames for Christ's glory, they'd rather do that than to live in luxury and comfort and have no purpose in life except for the worship and service of themselves. That's what sustained and nourished resolve in the midst of this great moment of crisis and challenge. They sacrifice comfort out of a desire and resolve to see God glorified above all. And so we have a relevant message in our text for contemporary Christianity. And that is that we're not to surrender faith on account of the difficulty of our circumstances or the hostility of an unbelieving world around us, which calls for us to bow down to its false gods of money and materialism and fame and comfort and recreation, medicine, science. What God would have His people do as we are in the midst of exile is to hold our ground. To hold our ground and to make the unseen things of faith visible by the way that we prioritize the glory of God in our life. That's what we're called to do. We are called in the midst of a hostile generation that believes faith is foolish because they can't see it under a microscope, to make the unseen things of faith visible by the way we order our lives for the glory of God. Just as these young Jewish men of faith did, saying, O king, the God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, let it be known, we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image which we have set up. Our call is to hold our ground, exalt our God, and maintain our faith by seeking to glorify God by obedience to his command. Our Father, we thank you for these old stories of faith, which when we come back to show themselves to have even greater depths of riches than we first understood. We're grateful to know that these are not Aesop's fables or fairy tales or fictional stories of principles which are designed to motivate us into action. These are the true words of the living God about great deeds performed of old to protect his church and to exalt his Christ. Help us, O Lord, to lay hold of your word by faith this morning and to praise your name with our heart and to glorify you, the Most High God, and to bow down before no counterfeits or worship any idols, but to reserve our full and complete allegiance, trust, and worship for you, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Hear us for Jesus' sake. Amen.